Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading some more chapters from The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Garner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Garner. In the previous chapter, we learned that Lieutenant Tragg had paid a call to Della's apartment and forced himself in. As the two were exiting, there was a loud squeal from the cat. Tragg followed Della into the kitchenette, where the two had to rescue the kitten, who crawled out the window and got caught on the clothesline and was hanging precariously several stories above the land below. Chapter 19. Perry Mason soaked up slumber. The consciousness of the broad daylight knifed its way through his brain. He sat up in bed long enough to look at his watch, fling the pillows into a new position, and drop back with a sense of languid comfort. He started drifting comfortably down into the welcome warmth of nerve-healing oblivion. The ringing of the buzzer on his doorbell irritated him back into consciousness. Mason decided to ignore the summons. He turned over, frowning the indetermination of his concentration. Damn the doorbell anyway! Probably someone wanting to sell something. Why hadn't I shut it off? The bell again. Well, let them ring. He wouldn't pay any attention to it. Again and again the bell rang. Mason found that his very determination to sleep was marshaling his faculties into wakefulness. He heard quick steps in the corridor, then knuckles banging uninterruptedly on his door. With an exclamation of irritation, Mason climbed out of bed, unlocked the door, and jerked it open. Paul Drake stood on the threshold, grinning at him. "How do you like it?" he asked. Mason said, "Damn it, I don't like it. Come on in." Drake followed the lawyer into his apartment, selected the most comfortable chair, twisted himself into a pretzel of comfort, and lit a cigarette. "Nice place you have here, isn't it?" Mason said sarcastically. Drake said, "A little chilly. I'll close this window. The breeze is coming in through there. Sunlight's pouring in through the other one. It's 11:30, Perry." "What the devil do I care about what time it is?" Drake tried to blow a smoke ring, watched the blue clouds of smoke drift out into the shaft of sunlight, and said, "You're always getting me up around the middle of the night, when you and Della have been out making whoopee. And seemed to me to think it's fun. Thought I'd interfere with your sleep, just so you can see how it feels." Mason, pulling the covers over his bare toes, grinned at the poetic justice of Drake's position, said, "It feels like hell," and reached for a cigarette. "Thought you'd like a report of what's going on." Mason tapped the end of the cigarette, carefully moistened the end of his tongue, lit a match, and said, "As soon as I finish with this cigarette, I'm going to throw you out and go back to sleep." He placed the match to the end of the cigarette. "Lots of things have been happening," Drake said. "Those bullets all came from the same gun." "Well, that's nothing new. Tragg's turned the whole police force upside down. He's working on every angle of the case, squeezing out every last bit of information." "I'm glad he is. The doctors give Jerry Templar 9 chances out of 10 to pull through. He stood the operation in fine shape." "Well, that's good. The kitten that was poisoned was taken down to the gardener's house for safekeeping. Chap by the name of Thomas Lunk," Mason said. "Lunk disappeared. So has the kitten," Mason said. "Listen, Paul, I can keep abreast of the current developments by reading the newspaper. I wanted you to get some angles everybody didn't know about, not trail along a few steps behind the police." Dwayne went on through, and he hadn't even heard Mason's remark. "Chap by the name of George Alber, he seems to stand ace high with Her Majesty Matilda Shore. Seems as though Matilda thinks Alber and Helen Kindle should get spliced. Albert thinks so, too. Albert's going places. He's going to amount to something in the world. He's attractive and magnetic. Helen is throwing herself away on a man who isn't all worthy of her. Aunt Matilda may leave her dough to Albert if Helen isn't a good girl." Mason sucked in a prodigious yawn. You are very annoying at times, Paul. Drake looked at him with humorless eyes. Do you find me that way? Mason knocked ashes off the end of his cigarette, snuggled back down under the covers. Matilda is out of the hospital and back at the house. Seems as though she's made a will in which she's tried to exert some pressure on Helen Kendall to make her marry young Albert. Albert apparently gets a very, very nice chunk of the Shore fortune one way or another. Either he gets it by marrying Helen, or if Helen doesn't marry him, he's taken care of very handsomely. Oh, and yes, your friend Lieutenant Trag is having the last few checks that went through Franklin Shore's account carefully experted. A $10,000 check to a man by the name of Rodney French seems to be the one he's particularly interested in. Rodney French is being looked for by the police. He seems to have taken a little vacation for himself, commencing yesterday evening. He neglected to tell anyone just where he was going. Mason said, Franklin Shore telephoned his bookkeeper. He was putting that $10,000 check through. That's right, Drake said, grinning. He did. Well, Mason asked. Trag's working on the theory that perhaps Franklin intended to put the check through, but pulled his disappearing act before he'd made out the check. That would make an interesting situation, wouldn't it, Perry? Put yourself in the position of a man who is depending on a $10,000 check from a chap whose name on the bottom of the check would have been made as good as a certificate of the United States Mint. Then the chap disappears, and he can't be found, and you've already committed yourself to things you're going to do on the assumption that check is going to go through. Anything else? Mason asked. Oh, yes. Trag's really working on that disappearance. It's a shame he wasn't in on it when it happened, but that was during the regime of our old friend, Sergeant Holcomb. Trag's going over all the unidentified bodies that were found around that time, getting the records out for an airing. He's found one body. The description doesn't check, however. He's also checking up on all the suicides around Florida in 1932. He's checking up on some mining property Leach was interested in, also making a very close check on the finances of Gerald Shores as of January 1932. A very, very resourceful chap, that Trag. Mason said, Phooey, Trag's just a damned misanthrope. Of course, he covers a lot of territory, Drake went on. Seems to think that kitten is rather an important factor in the entire situation. The kitten, eh? Mason observed. Uh-huh. Interesting chap, Trag. When he goes after something, he really gets it. The kitten, for instance? Mason asked very casually. Of course, the kitten. He has the kitten up at the district attorney's office. Mason sat bolt upright in the bed. How's that? He asked. Has the kitten up in the district attorney's office? Don't know just what he's doing with it, but where did he get it? I don't know. I picked up a lot of stuff from the newspaper boys, thinks that leak out through the police. He's asking questions of the chap who does the gardening out there, man by the name of Lunk. Mason became a moving mass of arms and legs, pinching out the cigarette, kicking the covers off, grabbing the telephone. The dial whirred through the number. Mason said, hello, hello, that you, Gertie? Where's Della this morning? No word from her, eh? Let me talk with Jackson. Hello, Jackson? This is an emergency. Give it a right away, everything in the office. Make out an application for writ of habeas corpus for Della Street. Make it wide enough, big enough, and broad enough to cover everything from rape to arson. She's being detained against her will. She's being examined concerning privileged communication. She's held without any charge being placed against her. She's abundantly able to furnish bail in any reasonable amount. Ask for the writ of habeas corpus and ask that she be admitted to bail pending the return and hearing of the writ. I'll sign and verify it. Get going on that thing now. Mason slammed up the telephone, peeled off his pajamas, splashed hurriedly into the shower, came out drying his belly, jerking clean underwear out of a drawer. Drake sat curled up in the chair, watching with a puzzled expression of growing concern while Mason hurried into his clothes. I have a 6-volt electric razor in the glove compartment of my car, Drake said. If you wanted to drive uptown with me, you could shave in the car. Mason jerked open the door of a coat closet, struggled into his overcoat, grabbed his hat, pulled gloves out over his overcoat pocket, said, "Come on, Paul, what's holding us back?" "Nothing," Drake said, uncoiling his double-jointed frame in a series of convolutions that would have done credit to a contortionist. "We're on our way, your office or the DA's." "My office first," Mason said. "When I talk with the DA, I always like to be able to slap him in the face with a writ of habeas corpus just in case he gets rough." "This bird getting rough?" Drake asked. "Uh-huh. Where's that razor?" Hamilton Berger, the district attorney, was a man with a huge chest, a thick neck, and heavy shoulders. There was about him a suggestion of the massive strength of a bear. He was given to making unpredictable moves with the swiftness of a man who concludes his deliberations before taking action. Once he started to act, he threw himself into that action with a concentrated force that eliminated any possibility of reexamining the situation. Lawyers who had come to know him well said that once Hamilton Berger started charging, it took a brick wall to stop him. As one attorney had expressed it, "Once Berger starts moving, he keeps moving until he's stopped, and it takes a hell of a lot to stop him." Mason knew that a reception had been prepared for him as soon as he entered the outer office of the district attorney. No assistant or trial deputy was assigned to interview him, but with the clock-like precision of a carefully thought-out bit of campaign strategy, Mason was whisked down the corridor and into the district attorney's office almost as soon as he announced himself at the reception desk. Hamilton Berger surveyed Mason with glittering, steady eyes. "Sit down," he said. Mason took the chair across from Berger's desk. "Do you want to talk to me, or am I going to talk to you?" Mason asked. "I'm talking to you," Berger said. "Go ahead," Mason told him. "Do your talking first. I'll say what I have to say when you've finished." Hamilton Berger said, "You're unorthodox. Your methods are spectacular, dramatic, and bizarre." "You might add one additional word," Mason said. For a moment, there was a flicker in the district attorney's eyes. "Effective?" he asked. Mason nodded. "That is the thing which bothers me," Berger said. "I'm glad to hear you admit it." "It doesn't bother me in the way that you think, however," Berger went on. "It simply means that if your spectacular, dramatic, swashbuckling methods continue to be effective, we'll have every attorney at the bar trying to cut corners, playing legal sleight of hand to outwit the police. And heaven knows one of you in this county is plenty. If I beat the police to the correct solution of a crime, does that constitute outwitting the police?" "That isn't what I meant," Berger objected. "It's not our policy to prosecute the innocent. And understand this, Mason. I'm talking not only about what you do, but how you do it." "Well, what's wrong with my means?" "You don't try your cases in a courtroom. You don't sit in your office and interview clients. You go tearing around the country, working by a catch-as-catch-can method of grabbing evidence, refusing to take the police into your confidence, and..." "Wait a minute," Mason said. "Do the police take me into their confidence?" Berger ignored the question. "There have been times when I've cooperated with you because I thought you were cooperating with me, but it's always been the same spectacular, flamboyant, pulling the rabbit out of the hat business with you." Mason said, "Well, if the rabbit I'm looking for happens to be in a hat, why not pull it out?" "Because you usually furnish the hat. You can't justify a legal hocus-pocus simply because you eventually squirm your way out. Now, I'll quit talking generalities with you. I'll get down to specific instances." "That would be fine." "Specifically," Berger said, "last night you uncovered a valuable, vital witness in a murder case. If the police had had the testimony of that witness, they might have solved the case by this time. As it was, they were given no opportunity. You and your secretary whisked this witness out from under the noses of the police." "You mean Lunk?" Mason asked. "I mean Lunk." "Well, go ahead." "You took him to a hotel and secreted him. You did everything in your power to keep the police from finding him. The police have found him." "What are they trying to do with him?" Mason asked. "If he's not so valuable, let him go ahead and solve the case." I'm afraid it isn't that simple, Berger said. Why not? We've uncovered some evidence that up to now has been unnoticed in connection with Franklin Shore's disappearance. What? Mason asked. Specifically, that $10,000 check which was given to Rodney French may have been a forgery. Mason settled back in the chair, crossed his legs. All right, let's discuss that. I'll be glad to hear your ideas on it, Berger said, with a stiff formality. In the first place, Franklin Shore told his bookkeeper he had put through such a check, Mason replied easily. I will correct you there, Berger said, consulting his notes. The testimony of the bookkeeper, as given 10 years ago, was to the effect that Franklin Shore said he was putting through such a check. Mason waved the point aside. All right, suppose he said he was putting through that check. That establishes its authenticity. But if the check was forged, the statute of limitations has run out. At present, that check business can have no legal significance. Berger said, the check could furnish a motivation. For what? For murder. Go ahead, I'm listening. If we had been able to get in touch with Lunk last night, it quite possibly we could have uncovered some very valuable additional evidence. Do you want to be more specific? Yes, I think we could have found Franklin Shore. And I'm accused of keeping you from getting in touch with Lunk? Exactly, Mason said. I'll puncture that theory right now. The first thing I did with Lunk was to take him down to the hospital to see Matilda Shore. That was where he wanted to go. But, and get this point straight, Berger, because it's legally important, in place of trying to keep away from the police, I took him to the hospital, knowing the police were guarding Matilda Shore. I told the police guards who Lunk was. I told them that he wanted to see Mrs. Shore, that he might have some important evidence, and that Trag might want to see him. What more can anyone ask? Berger nodded. That's an outstanding example of your cleverness, Mason. As far as Lunk is concerned, that one very clever move virtually gives you immunity from any prosecution. You could stand up in front of a jury, and yet you know, and I know, that you deliberately staged that entire visit so that the guards would eject him and you. You did it simply to give yourself a legal insurance policy. Mason grinned. I can't help it if you fill out your police force with morons. I took Lunk there, told them who he was. They pushed him back in the elevator, and they told him to get out and stay out. I understand, Berger said patiently. Now let me call your attention to something. Under our law, any person who willfully prevents or persuades a person who is or who may become a witness from attending upon any inquiry authorized by law is guilty of a misdemeanor. Mason nodded. And under another law, if any person gives or promises to give such a witness a bribe to keep him away, he's guilty of a felony. Go right ahead, Mason said. I'm interested in your theory. Under the decisions, Berger said, it isn't necessary that this attempt should be successful, nor does the witness have to actually be kidnapped. It has been held in one of our sister states that it's a crime within the meaning of a similar law to get a witness intoxicated so he couldn't testify. Mason said, well, I didn't bribe anyone and I didn't get anyone intoxicated. What's all the shouting and shooting about? Berger said, Lunk adopts a sullen, defiant attitude toward the police and won't tell us what he knows. However, he isn't too intelligent. Once you understand his peculiar psychology and take time to work with him, it's possible to get a story out of him, a bit at a time. Well, Lunk has told us enough so that we know Franklin Shore was at his house, that your secretary went out and picked him up. Trag had told you specifically he wanted Franklin Shore as a witness to appear before the grand jury. Mason said, go ahead and finish what you have to say, and then I'll tell you how I feel about it. You want the last word, eh? Mason nodded. Berger said, Mason, I'm going to hit you where it hurts, and I'm going to hit you hard. By picking on my secretary, I suppose? Berger said. You got her into this. I didn't. You kept Lunk tied up while she jumped in a cab and went to Lunk's residence. Got Franklin Shore out of bed, told him that he had to get out, and made arrangements to conceal him. You can prove all of this, I presume? I can prove it by circumstantial evidence. You know very well, Mason, that you wanted to talk with Franklin Shore before the police did. You sent your secretary out there to pick up Franklin Shore and conceal him. Does she admit that? No, she doesn't. She doesn't have to admit it. We've got the evidence to prove it. When you say prove, what do you mean? I mean to the satisfaction of a jury. I don't believe it. It's circumstantial evidence, Berger said, but we have it. You've got it, like I've got the Hope Diamond, Mason said insultingly. Hamilton Berger met his eyes unflinchingly. I've sympathized with some of these things that you've done in the times past, Mason. I have been so intrigued by your rapid-fire methods and the results you have achieved that I haven't realized that as far as justice was concerned, the viciousness of those methods more than offsets the benefits achieved. Now then, I'm going to pull your house of cards down. How? I'm going to convict your secretary of spiriting off a material witness in a murder case. After that, I'm going to try you as an accessory, and I'm going to convict you. Then I'm going to have you disbarred and the strength of those convictions. Now you probably have a writ of habeas corpus in your pocket that you've been preparing to slap down on my desk as your last word. Go ahead and slap it. I have no desire to be unduly harsh with Miss Street. I'm proceeding against her because that's the only way I can get at you. I don't intend to confine Miss Street in jail. I am perfectly willing to let you have your writ of habeas corpus. I am perfectly willing to see that she's admitted to bail. And I am, however, going to convict her of a crime. If she wants to apply for probation, that's all right. I won't stand in her way. Then I'm going to convict you of a crime. I'm not going to ask for a jail sentence. I'm going to see that a fine is imposed and that I am going to use that conviction to terminate your activities as a member of the bar. Berger pushed back his swivel chair and got to his feet. Now then, the last word that you were talking about, that business of slapping the writ of habeas corpus on my desk, loses some of its dramatic punch, doesn't it, Mason? Mason got to his feet, stared across the desk at the district attorney. All right, I told you I was going to have the last word, now I'll have it. Berger, the trouble with you is that you've hypnotized yourself by looking at law entirely from the viewpoint of a district attorney. District attorneys have organized themselves as they've organized public sentiment. You have gradually lulled the public into feeling of confidence that it can trust you to see that no innocent person is ever knowingly prosecuted. Hamilton Berger said, I am glad to hear you admit that, Mason. You shouldn't be. You should be sorry. Why? Because the public has sat idly by and let organized prosecutors amend the law until the constitutional guarantees of the public were swept away. We're living in a period of changing times. It's quite possible that the definition of crime will be broadened to include things which we might at present list in the category of political crime. When the ordinary citizen is dragged into court, he'll find that the cards have been stacked against him. Ostensibly, they were stacked against the profound criminal by organized public servants, but actually they've been stacked against Mr. and Mrs. Ordinary Citizen, because the whole legal procedure has been completely undermined. It's high time for citizens to wake up to the fact that it isn't a question of whether a man is guilty or innocent, but whether his guilt or innocence can be proved under a procedure which leaves the citizens the legal right to which he is entitled under a constitutional government. You object to spectacular dramatic methods of defense. You overlook the fact that for the past 25 years you've been beguiling the public into releasing its constitutional rights so that only effective methods of defense which are left are the spectacular and the dramatic. Now then, Mr. District Attorney, you go ahead and arrest Della Street and we'll thrash this thing out in the courtroom. Berger said, that's right, Mason. We'll thrash it out in the courtroom. And if you ask me, your last word didn't amount to much. Mason paused in the doorway, his face hard with anger. I haven't had the last word yet, he said. I'll have it in court. And he slammed the door behind him. Well, we have a pretty hairy mess right now. What's Mason going to do? Is he going to go to court? Is Berger going to throw him in jail? Well, we'll have to continue more. Next week, in The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. That completes our readings for today. I do hope you've enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.